Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We may look like apes and act like them too sometimes, but can you look in the mirror and see a fish? Paleontologist Neil Shubin is here to say we still share plenty of traits with our aquatic ancestors. You may be surprised how much. And the more we know about our evolutionary past, the more we understand about our body's fishy design and the way it shapes our lives in and out of the pool. This hour, On Point, paleontologist Neil Shubin and getting to know our inner fish. Joining me now from Chicago is Neil Shubin, paleontologist and evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago. On a dig in the Arctic in 2004, he unearthed the fossil Tiktaalik rosea, the fish with hands, as the press has had it, that crawled out of the waters 375 million years ago. He writes about that discovery and much more in his new book, Your Inner Fish, a journey into the 3.5 billion-year history of the human body. Neil Shubin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
It's a great adventure story and science story all wrapped in one. I really enjoyed it. You talk at one point, though, we'll get to that, how you dug this out of the icy rock in the Arctic. But you talk in the book about the zoo in you. What do you mean by that, Neil?
Yeah, what we have are bits and pieces of our body that are seen in other creatures. I mean, the fundamentals of our humanity are actually developed out of bits and pieces seen in everything from jellyfish and sponges to worms, fish, all the way up to apes and so forth. So the idea is when you look at a human body, you can see our deep evolutionary past within us. It's almost like peeling an onion. You know, first you see our past as that we share with apes. Then you see our past we share with other mammals and go on down to reptiles and fish and worms and so forth. You can peel an onion and see layer after layer of history buried inside our bodies, in every organ, in every cell, and every gene.
You know, that's easy to imagine at one level, and yet when it gets down to the details, not necessarily so easy for somebody who's not in your business. You say you can track it back to bacteria and clams and worms and jellyfish, but it's fish yes. that you put right on the kind of the cover here and at the heart of it. Give us some examples of what in our bodies that we can sense or understand today can be tracked back to life before it came on land.
Well, let's just take the experience we're sharing now. The bones that I'm using to talk to you with and the muscles and nerves that are controlling those activities actually correspond to the bones and muscles and nerves that control and structure the gills in fish and sharks and other creatures. And we know that with great certainty because what we can do is look at how we develop. If you look at our early development as tiny little embryos, as we go from egg to adult, what we go through is a series of stages where the front of where our head is has a series of swellings that look for all the world like gill arches. In fact, that's what they're called. And if you look at a shark or a fish, what you see is the same thing. The cells inside those gill arches in us form the bones of our jaw, bones of parts of our ear, our voice box, and other structures up there. In fish, what do they do? In sharks, what do they do? Well, what they do is form parts of the gill structures and so forth. And we can follow this with great certainty through both fossils and genes and development to lead to the surprising place that many of the bones that we use to talk, to chew, to hear, and so forth actually correspond to the bones and other structures in fish. And I can do this with structure after structure of our bodies.
We'll do that, and I can't wait. It's not just the structures. You say even something like hiccups, you can trace back to fish. How? What?
Yeah, what you have is, a hiccup when you do a that sort of thing. It's a stereotyped sort of pattern where your glottis closes and you have a rapid contraction of your diaphragm and so forth. And the neurological pattern that generates that is set deep within the base of the brain and spinal cord. And so what you have is a thing called a central pattern generator. It's a stereotypical pattern of muscle and nerve and muscle activity that controls the hic. And what you see is where else do we find that sort of structure is actually we see it in creatures that actually use their both lung and gill breathing, where actually what they do is they have to close their glottis and do that stereotypical sort of hic as a form of breathing. And where they're seen is things like tadpoles and others.
Are you saying then that when we get the hiccups, we are literally demonstrating an involuntary, I don't know if behavior is the right word, but action that literally comes down in an evolutionary path from fish gulping in water?
Yeah, and actually through things that have a larval stage that have both gills and lungs. And so it's like almost an inner tadpole or inner larva, if you will.
The inner tadpole. Give us some more examples here. You talked with Stephen Colbert on the Colbert Report earlier this week, and he had a grand time with breasts and hair and teeth and feathers.
Yeah.
But what about those? Make some more connections here. Breast, hair, teeth, feathers. What?
Well, let's start with something a little more sane, and that is the our arms and legs. Our arms and legs correspond to the fins of fishes. And in fact, it's a very detailed comparison that we can make between the bones in our arms and legs and the bones in many fish fins, particularly things like Tiktaalik, the creature that my colleagues and I discovered in the 375-million-year-old rocks. So arms and fins, portions of our brain can be traced all the way down to fishes, indeed even some worms. And most fundamentally, it's not just the story of history is not just written in our skeletons and in our structures. It's written in the DNA recipe that builds our bodies. You see, what's great here is our bodies are built by a recipe. We begin as a single egg, a single-celled egg. And over time, we become a 2-trillion-cell adult.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's the unfolding of that information from that single cell to the 2 trillions of cells that make us that's contained within our DNA largely as well as other things. But what's important here is science is coming to grips with the recipe, the DNA recipe that actually builds bodies. And understanding that is taking us to some very surprising and some very important places. One of those is that the recipe that builds our bodies actually is very, very ancient.
That DNA, that recipe gives us life. It also, you points out in your inner fish, gives us some problems, some limitations because of that line of descent. Like what?
Well, I mean, we have many problems. I mean, for instance, human males have a susceptibility to a certain kind of hernia. And the reason why we have that susceptibility to that particular kind of hernia is that our spermatic cord takes a weird loop from our scrotum to get to our penis. It goes loop-de-loop around the pelvis.
Ooh.
And you can say, well, that's not a very intelligent design to a body. I mean, you would not do these weird loop-to-loops you see in the spermatic cord or the weird courses many nerves and arteries and vessels in our bodies take.
Okay, I'm trying to follow. Yeah, where are you going?
Okay, so the reason why our body takes these weird loops can only be really understood is when we consider our fishy past. So, for instance, we begin our development looking much like an embryo of a fish,
mm-hmm.
where, believe this or not, the testes are actually lying closer to the heart near the chest. Now, fish, and many fish, and particularly sharks, the testes actually stay up there in that general area. So when you cut open a shark and you look inside, you'll find the testes
you see
not
the
lower.
Giant shark liver,
and then
nestled in there, yep.
Yeah, and you'll see them really high up. It's a surprising place. So we begin like that, actually. But then we depart because as human males, as we develop, and in females too, the gonads descend, the ovaries. But in males, they descend even further to a sac that sits out the body, which we call the scrotum.
Mm.
And the reason why that happens is for a variety of reasons. The scrotum's a sexual signal. Mammalian sperm in particular is very temperature sensitive.
Mm.
So you have this sac that can be where temperatures can be controlled. But in the process of making that sac and descending the testes, what you have is you've created a weird loop-de-loop in our spermatic cord. And to make that loop-de-loop, we have an opening or a weak spot in our body wall.
Explaining why infant males sometimes get hernias.
Bingo. Or adult males, when they're lifting weights or sneezing or coughing, may have a weakness that develops there. And, it's a particular kind of hernia. There are many other types of hernias. But this particular kind of hernia is literally, our fishy past coming back to hurt us.
Wow. So it's really not just that what looks like stone fossil. It's really what we're walking around with. It's the DNA package that we carry even now, even unto hernias.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of the story, right? I mean, it tells us so much about how science is working nowadays. What we're after is fundamental questions about who we are and how we got that way. To get to those answers, what we need are fossils. That's a big part of the story. But we also compare anatomies. We compare embryos. And importantly, we now have DNA at our disposal. So science is becoming much more interdisciplinary, that we're using many fields to answer some of our big questions.
And with that, we begin to learn things about us that we may have never known before. The medical community seems to be wide open to this. I mean, they've had you in teaching anatomy, Mr. Paleontologist.
Well, it's not unusual, actually. Harvard has done that for years, where I trained, and other other institutions. It's remarkable. When I came to Chicago back in the year 2000, mm-hmm. I was actually sort of pressed into service to direct the human anatomy course to first-year medical students. And actually, it turns out that being a paleontologist is a giant advantage in teaching anatomy, because you know the structure of bodies very well. And indeed, understanding fish and reptiles and other things gives us a wonderful roadmap to understanding our own bodies. But I remember all kinds of fun conversations I had with the first-year medical students. I mean, this is a very pivotal class, and informative in their becoming future doctors. And they'd ask me, you know, Dr. Shubin, what kind of doctor are you? And you know, they're thinking, are you a surgeon? Are you an internist? And I'd say, well, I'm a fish paleontologist, you know. And after
wait,
a few minutes,
what?
You're right. And so after we got through that experience, it becomes very fun, because, you know, we can use evolution and other creatures as roadmaps to the much more complicated structures in our own bodies.
Out on the horizon with my aqualung, in a second now I'm holding my nose and taking the brine.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about our evolutionary journey from the seas to stand-up primate, the worms, reptiles, and fish, our ancestors who made us what we are today, and how they still show up in our bodies. Neil Shubin joins me from Chicago, University of Chicago, paleontologist. His new book is Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 billion-year History of the Human Body. Roger's calling from Amesbury, Massachusetts. Roger, you're on the air with Mr. Paleontologist Neil Shubin.
I had a question. Is there anything in the fish record that would suggest why human ears, nose, and throat are all connected? Because every time I get a cold, I wonder why it feels like I'm drowning.
Oh, man, that's a really good... That's a great question.
Yep,
because there are multiple layers here. The first layer is that some of the genes that actually make our eye, the parts of our ears and other parts of that area, actually have many effects. That is, they don't only just affect the region of the ear, but they affect portions of the throat, nose, even parts of the eye. And you can trace the origin of those particular set of genes that build this area down to jellyfish. So to some extent, some of the birth defects that we see in hospitals today that affect the multiple regions in that area you're talking about relate to a very deep part of our past. But actually what you're referring to is the sort of the passages and the connections that are maintained between our ear cavity, your sinus cavity in your mouth, or your pharynx. And those actually relate to a gill history. So what you begin with is these gill slits I talked about earlier, which is much like an embryo of a fish. And what happens is these openings and passages develop through, while pockets are forming. So it's actually we begin our development looking much like a fish embryo. And it's because of that that we have many of these passages and so forth that develop.
But are you saying that the jellyfish is in our line of descent? I would have thought that would have come after we sort of split off from this ancient...
But it's not the jellyfish itself. It's a common ancestor we share with the jellyfish.
I see.
Which is a jellyfish-like thing. But absolutely, we have a history that goes very deep. We have a common history we share with sponges. We have a common history we share with single-celled organisms. And the beauty is I can present evidence for this that's written in our own DNA. And you could see this in many of the genes in our body. And it's not just one gene. It's many genes. It's a remarkable story because it's supported by so many lines of evidence.
Show us more linkages, feathers, hair, breast, teeth, you name it. They are such great stories.
Yes, that's a good one. So it turns out if you look at organs that develop within skin, so-called integumentary organs that develop between interactions between layers of skin, there's an overall similarity in the recipe that makes those. So there's an overall similarity in the recipe that makes pretty much all the glands that develop in skin, whether it's a breast or a sweat gland or something like that. And that has similarities to the recipe that builds things like teeth even, or hairs and feathers. So these, what we call integumentary, or in more common language skin organs, share fundamentals of a basic recipe. So in a biological sense, there are real similarities among these things. But there's another really cool thing. Let's just take a great example. Mm. I mean, think of our ears. You know, let's just walk through our ear and let's look at the history inside our ear. You know, the first thing you see is
it's flap. It's kind of crowded in here for starters walking through, but okay. It's sort of flat, you say?
Yeah, the flap. You know, the flap where you hang your glasses.
Yeah.
Or, you
the
know,
lobe.
The pinna. That is actually a relatively recent addition to our bodies. That's part of our mammalian past. So let's go inside our ear. As you go inside our ear from that external part, what you go into is an area called the middle ear. And the middle ear contains a series of three small bones and muscles that control them.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that two of those bones are part of the past we share with reptiles. One of those bones is part of the past we share with fish, like Tiktaalik. And then let's go even to the inner part of our ear, that part of our ear which actually controls the neurological mechanisms that do our hearing. That piece is actually really ancient. That traces to creatures like jawless fish. And in fact, the DNA recipe that builds that actually can be traced to things like the common ancestor we share with jellyfish. So I like to think that there's an entire tree of life inside our ears. And that story that's written in our ears is actually can be seen throughout our bodies and other organ systems as well. I could do the same thing with limbs and guts and so forth.
Well, take us back to that moment when you were pulling Tiktaalik, the fish that walked out of the stone in the very far north Canadian Arctic. That takes us – you've got fins, which are not like other fishes' fins. You go back 375 million years, you say, from the record there. And here's the fish that it seems may have been – this was among the ones who came out of the water onto land. First of all, why would they have done that? And secondly, what did it, I don't know, entail or require physically of their you know, biology to do it?
Okay, so the what you have is about 375 million years ago is sort of the transition from life in water to life on land, and that's what drove us to the Arctic to find Tiktaalik. And when I say us, my colleagues and I, Ted Deschler and Ferris Jenkins,
right.
We're doing this.
Seems like kind of a cold place for this to have happened, just for starters.
Yeah. I mean, it's cold today, but, you know, what's really kind of fun here is, you know, you stand in the Arctic digging Tiktaalik, right?
Mm.
And you're looking in the distance, and what do you see? You see glaciers. You see muskox, you know, and if you're unlucky, you'll see a polar bear, you know. But then you look inside the rocks, and what do you see? You see a tropical world. Inside the rocks is a world with plants that grow in warm weather.
The North Pole was a jungle, or this moved there somehow?
Exactly. You have this disconnect between what's in the North Pole today and what's inside the rocks of the North Pole area. And that's because the continents moved. What is today up in Ellesmere Island at a latitude of about 80 north was once closer to the equator.
Okay.
So what you have with Tiktaalik is a creature that was living in ancient streams. And we know that from the geology of the area that we found the creature in.
Looks kind of like an alligator. Flat head, eyes up on top of the head, and then these big bulky fins which are almost like front legs or arms.
Yeah, what's remarkable about Tiktaalik is, you know, you look at the creature, and the first time you see it, you say, oh, that's a fish, you know? I mean, it has scales on its back, and it has fin webbing, right? And then, if you know paleontology, it's like, wait, there's a disconnect here. Because it has a flat head, like some early amphibians, it has a neck, which fish don't have. And then when you look inside the fin webbing, and take it off, what you find is you find bones that correspond to our upper arm bone, our forearms, even parts of our wrist. You find a wonderfully functional shoulder, elbow, and wrist. And then it gets even better because Tiktaalik is so well preserved and we have several specimens of it. It's not just one.
Mm.
We can begin to look at its anatomy to ask the question is, what did Tiktaalik do? What did it use these fins for? And for that, we can look to the structure of the joints and the structure of the way the bones not only fit together but how the muscles likely fit around it. And it's very clear that Tiktaalik was developed and accentuating one big function, and that's the function you do in the gym, which is a bench press or a push-up. It had a palm area of its fin that would lie flush against the ground, and the joints are clear evidence of this, and an elbow that was bent. So it's a fish that could do a push-up.
In other words, it could lift itself up off the sand.
Bingo. It could support itself with its fins. And it gets even better because then when you look at the ribs of Tiktaalik, they're not like any fish rib. They are big, fat things that fit together that clearly support the body under gravity. So, you know, if we look at structure after structure of Tiktaalik, this is clearly an animal that's supporting itself, you know, I mean, and doing a form of a push-up.
Well, what's the evolutionary logic here? Why wouldn't it just have stayed under the sea, you know, eating shrimp and clams and having a great old time?
Great question. I mean, it helps to look at the creatures that Tiktaalik is found with. These are creatures about 10 to 20 feet long with teeth the size of railroad spikes. I mean, this is a horrific time period. Everything's kind of a predator. There are big fish with big teeth.
So under the sea was a jungle. And I mean, it was a rough environment.
It was a fish-eat-fish world, we like to joke. You know? And so the strategy is either, you know, get big, right, get armor, or get out of the way. You know, it looks like things like Tiktaalik are getting out of the way. I mean, there's no way you'd want to be swimming in these ancient streams. We would not have lasted long.
And so it may just have hoisted itself up on those fins turning into bench press forearms and trucked out of there.
Yeah, and so it was clearly specialized for life, you know, in the shallows or on the mudflats and so forth. I mean, remember, Tiktaalik, we know, had both gills and lungs. So it was still able to live in the water and able to escort. So it's truly a remarkable sort of intermediate fossil found at the right time in the fossil record.
Neil Shubin, lots of people want to speak with you. Let's turn to more. Bob, calling from Lebanon, New Hampshire. Hi, Bob. You're on the air with the paleontologist Neil Shubin.
Hello. Thank you.
Yeah.
I have a question. The gentleman is talking about the similarities, but it would seem to me that there are major, major differences. We are mammals. We don't lay eggs. We're primates. And I'm wondering if the similarities between us and fish are so great, why don't we lay eggs? I mean, why would there have been such changes?
That's a really good question.
Well, the types of births, I guess we're talking about, and the fact that we are mammals, we suckle our young. I'm wondering if there's any answer to that question as to why we would have changed so much in the past few million years.
Great. Neil Shubin? Many million years, yeah.
Yeah.
The first is, if we look at really primitive mammals alive today, guess like monotremes and stuff, the really most primitive mammals that are on the Earth today, what's remarkable about them is they lay eggs. You know? So it turns out that there are mammals that actually living mammals that sort of bridge that gap, which is really, truly remarkable. And then we find a diversity of reproductive strategies in mammals. One of the things here is really is to think of the notion of family trees and relationships. There's really sort of strong medical power to understand – let's just take my own family as an example, to understand the similarities and differences I have with my father. I'm genetically related to my dad, and there are enormous similarities between him and me. And those similarities are very explanatory. They can help doctors understand, you know, our genetic disposition to develop certain kinds of diseases, our predilection for certain kinds of possible behaviors, and, you know, all kinds of other stuff. But there's also important differences between me and my dad. And those differences relate to the fact that we, you know, our lineage as well, but also the environment we were raised in. And so to understand the basic biology of me and my father, you have to understand our relatedness, which has – relatedness has two sides to its coin. It has the similarities that you share with your relatives, but importantly, also the differences that develop. And so to understand the biology of an organism, we have to understand both the similarities and differences. That same reasoning that I applied to my father and me, I can apply to you know, our species and our you know, father species and our family tree of species.
But you're one generation apart from your dad. I mean, that's
I'm gazillions from. Yeah, we're dealing with 50 zillion trillion cousins away. But the same reasoning applies very well. In fact, you know, we can actually see written in our genes a family tree-like structure. That looks a lot like the tree-like structure that you'd see in comparing my father and me and my grandfather and grandmother and so forth. And so there's a power to that. And so what we can then begin to ask the question is, genetically, what makes what's the genetic recipe that makes a toolkit – what's the genetic toolkit or recipe that makes a mammal like a human different from a mammal like a mouse? And we can ask another question, what's the genetic recipe that makes a mammal like a mouse different from a reptile like a lizard and a fish like a trout, and just work all the way down. Mm-hmm. And what's remarkable here is we can begin to answer those questions. And so that's the power of this. It really comes down to understanding relatedness.
Yeah, Bob in New Hampshire, let me ask you, do you have the sense that if we were fish then, we should still be fish today? I mean, that it would be static for some reason?
No. I believe in evolution, and it's just a question: is why the differences came about? I guess whether it was because fish evidently started crawling on land. I'm wondering if perhaps in crawling up on land, it became inconvenient to lay eggs, and somehow a transformation took place in which the baby started forming in the body. It's just those kinds of things that interest me.
Well, what happens is you have evolution acts by, variation among individuals and then natural selection. And what's happening during the course of this time, what you're talking about here, is an interval of time from when, Tiktaalik existed, which is about 375 million years ago, to when the earliest mammals came about, and that's about, 200 or so million years ago. So what you're talking about here is a window of time of about 175 million years. That's an enormous chunk of time. And what happened during that enormous chunk of time is many changes to the Earth's atmosphere, the shape of the continents, the flora that existed on the Earth, the constellation of other creatures that existed on the Earth. So the world of about 200 million years ago, when these egg-laying mammals shifted to development in a uterus, was a very different world from the world that Tiktaalik saw in many, many, many ways, both the other creatures it was living with as well as the structure of the place. So this is a long way of saying that what happens is creatures follow a path of evolution based on their own history, that is, they have their own inertia, if you will, but also the environments are changing, both globally and locally. And it's the response to that that leads to the family tree we see. And that's why not every species looks alike. That's why birds look one way and mammals look another way and so forth.
Love these examples. You go to human sensory activity and connections there between the way we perceive the world, our nerve system, and the way ancient aquatic ancestors may have.
Yeah, and that, you think about the shift from water to land. I mean, that's a big time shift. Mm. I mean, living in water, you hear differently, you see differently, you're feeding differently, the water's supporting you, excretion's different. In land, it's an utterly different environment. And if I was to take an envelope and list all the things, life in water and life on land, I would look at that list and say, boy, that's an impossible transition. No way, no how that could happen. And that's what got me. These are the puzzles that got me into the field in the first place as a scientist, to sort of solve these riddles. And we're fortunate here in that we have a wonderful fossil record, particularly for this fish amphibian transition. What it shows is that actually this gap can be bridged by creatures that are, intermediate between fish and amphibian. It's really remarkable.
Paleontologist Neil Shubin is with us. He was way up in the Canadian Arctic not so many years ago, pulling out Tiktaalik, the fossil example, and more than one, of that shift from aquatic to land life. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Do you know what your body owes to ancient sea creatures? And if our leaders don't acknowledge evolution, can our children really know themselves? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Neil Shubin's new book is Your Inner Fish. Pam's calling right now from Montreal in Canada. Hi, Pam. You're on the air.
Hello. It's a slight sort of trivial question I have. But in my mother, who's passed away now, she had a small hole. It would look like an ear piercing by the side of the right ear. And this produced some secretion. And now my son has it. My son, that began as a small spot in the same place, and it developed into a hole over the ears, and both of them get secretion.
So what does it leave you thinking or wondering,
Pam? It leaves me thinking we have, between that and a slight webbed toad, we must come from the fish.
So, you wonder if that's the kind of a...
Pardon?
You wonder if that's kind of the, I don't know, something out of the pages of deep history showing up
yes.
there.
Well, actually, and that's interesting. I mean, I don't know what the cause of...
The phone suggested it might be cod liver oil.
I don't know about that. What do you think? Do we somehow, do people get born with, you know, vestigial weird anomalies that do show up from that ancient connection, Neil?
Yes, my colleagues in the surgery department here deal with that all the time. I don't know about this particular condition that's being described. Yeah. There are conditions known called branchial cysts, where you'll have an opening or a sac that's retained in the area between the gill slits. So it's almost like a gill opening that's been retained into adult stages, and almost it corresponds to that in fish. Those are actually relatively common. I mean, I don't mean that you're going to see them every day, but in the course of a year, you'll see a number of these cases. And for the most part, they're benign.
But when people looked at
yes, there are the
I mean,
past,
do you actually
pieces
do people
of our fish-like.
Yep, sorry.
There are pieces of our fish-like past that really does appear and has to be corrected. Very, 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 very rarely there are sight of a metastasis, and that's for biological reasons that people don't know.
Pam, who knows? Maybe it's an evolutionary step forward and we just don't know it yet. Keep an eye on that boy of yours. Let's go to Colton, North Carolina, and Steve. Steve, you're on the air with Neil Shubin.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah.
I was wondering if evolution is ongoing. In other words, I wonder about the fish today. Will they eventually evolve to something like the fish millions of years ago did? Or, you know, or maybe I'll have a northern pike looking up and finding me as an ancestor?
Or maybe still crawl out in another place and then develop off in some other direction entirely.
Yeah, right. I mean, it started millions of years ago, but why wouldn't the fish today evolve to something, or will it?
Neil, how do you think about it? It can't be over, I guess, if it never ends.
No, the story's never over. I mean, that's a great question. So, I mean, the evolution's going on around us. I mean, even in our bodies. I mean, one of the neat stories that's happened over the past few years is people working on the human genome and looking at human populations. They're showing evidence that our own genomes are evolving by natural selection. This is in humans. Same thing's happening in fish and reptiles and worms and so forth. Now, you ask a really good question is it possible to see the fish-amphibian transition over the next few million years? It's an interesting, you know, one thing we see very frequently in paleontology when we look at how sort of ecologies evolve over time is a principle called incumbency. It's almost like sort of the king of the hill principle. Once there's a species occupying a particular niche or area, sometimes it's very hard for other species to do that, to get to the top of the hill, if you will. It's almost like the king of the hill game. You know, for all I know, that may be the case in the transition from water to land. Remember, when Tiktaalik was around, there were no other backboned animals on land. There were just sort of invertebrate animals, bugs and their relatives, and plants. So it was sort of an open space, if you will. You know, there was kind of no competition, and there was nobody to, you know, clobber them. And so, it may be the reason, you know, why we haven't seen the fish-amphibian transition happening actually since Tiktaalik. We've seen creatures return to the water, but not evolve on land, at least vertebrates.
So now that we're camped out and building retirement homes along every lake and stream in America, there's no room for fish to crawl out anymore?
It's kind of like the king of the hill principle. We actually see that very locally in lots of ecological situations. And so it may be at work here, for all I know.
Let's go to John in Newton, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, my question basically was as far as Tiktaalik, once she got on land, as far as breeding was concerned, I'm guessing that maybe they had gills and they're used to breeding underwater. So as far as how were they able to just breathe on land? And furthermore, is this a point in time where there was no other predators on land so that, because I'm guessing a fish that can do push-ups could still be pretty vulnerable to predators on land too, as well as in the water.
Yeah, Neil.
Yeah, let me take them one at a time. The Tiktaalik had, but we have solid evidence that Tiktaalik had both gills and lungs. So think of Tiktaalik as truly a amphibious sort of animal, kind of actually more on the aquatic / shallows mudflat side. So it clearly had lungs. So the shift there, actually lungs evolved in fish living in water. That's one of the important observations.
Why would that have happened?
Well, lungs are used for a variety of different things. When oxygen levels get low in the water, fish tend to evolve all kinds of things we call accessory respiratory organs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a complicated way of saying is fish tend to evolve all kinds of ways of gulping air. And you see lots of different strategies here. Where fish evolve a highly vascularized mouth, which mm-hmm. enables them to gulp air and for it to function in respiratory function. But then we also see fish evolving lungs. And these are used in times when the oxygen supply in the water is actually low. And there are many situations where that happens. And the lineage that led to Tiktaalik had lungs well before Tiktaalik hit the scene. Hmm. Furthermore, Tiktaalik has ribs, which are usually used to control breathing in lungs. We don't know whether that was the case here in Tiktaalik or not for sure. But the answer is really clear. I mean, Tiktaalik clearly had both gills and lungs. So the actual commitment to land, you know, which happened much later, actually happened with the loss of gills, not the origin of lungs. So
and the non-vertebrates who were there on land were not really a challenge to these critters, as you described.
No, and they're probably very juicy and tasty. What you look at is their large invertebrates, you know, arthropods, bug-like things, flying animals and crawling animals and so forth. There are plants on land as well. You know, when you look at the sort of inhabitants of land, the first things to appear on land are the plants. Then follow sort of the invertebrate animals, and then follow our lineage, the bony animals.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Jeff in Jeffersonville, Vermont. Hi, Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. My question is, how does a whole order of animals go from egg laying to live birth? I mean, obviously there's going to be some sort of transition period. What is that going to look like? Is it all of a sudden all the animals? I mean, an animal born from an egg will then be so structurally different from its own DNA, parent DNA, that it's then going to give birth? Or are there several animals doing this? Or is there a transition of, like, soft eggs within the body that are born? I mean, how does that work?
Neil?
Sure. Let's think of sharks. That's actually a really good example. Because there's, you know, we tend to think, well, we're mammals, and so the shift is really big, egg to internal fertilization and internal development. But, you know, there's all kinds of examples where animals switch back and forth in their modes of development. They vary between species or genera even. It's not even at the order level. If you look at sharks, for instance, there are species of sharks that develop internally with embryos. There are species of sharks that do not. There's all kinds of reproductive strategies we see. And in fact, if we look at the natural world, we find all kinds of variation in this that actually natural selection can act on. And that's how this would happen. I mean, if you didn't have variation for natural selection to act on, then this couldn't happen. And the important observation is that even these kinds of features show a substantial amount of variation. So that's the answer.
Neil, Charles Darwin talked about a missing link in his understanding of evolution. He worried that it would create vulnerability around the whole argument, the whole hypothesis theory. Is there still a missing link between the great fossil record and human beings as we kick around today, or has that been filled in by now?
Here's the important point. Science is about the unknown, not about the known. So as a working scientist, I'm actually thinking about things we don't know and trying to find answers to them. So when I look at the fossil record, I'm looking for gaps, things we don't know, because that's why I became a scientist, to explain things, to find new data that changes the way we think, that takes us off in a new direction or answers a fundamental question. And so when you ask, I mean, is every gap filled? No way. We have loads of gaps. If every gap was filled, we wouldn't need science. We'd be out of business. And so science is about discovering things and venturing into the unknown. Now, does that mean we don't have links between pretty much every transformation we see in the fossil record? We do have links. It's just, but when you think of, you know, the innumerable intermediate animals that would exist between species, we don't have all of them, nor will we ever. But we have enough to suggest and to show quite convincingly the family tree and the relatedness among many of the major groups we have on Earth today.
Let's go to Nick in Hampstead, New Hampshire. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I actually have two questions. I keep hearing this little voice in my head from my high school biology days that says something like, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, one of those things that, you know, you kind of get stuck in your head. And I was just kind of hoping that Neil might be able to comment on that. And then the second question, I would wonder if you would comment on I think it's convergent evolution, where we have two things leading to the same functionality. And the specific example that I have is the mammalian versus the cephalopodian eye. And I wonder if you can comment on that. Thank you. I'll take my answer off to you.
Ooh, there's plenty to unpack. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. Yeah. You say that and you don't quite agree with that. Unpack that for those of us who don't recall our high school biology.
Let me explain. So when you say ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, what you're saying is, you know, you learn that during development from egg to adult, an organism supposedly would track its evolutionary history so that, you know, during a human development, we go through a worm stage, a fish stage, a reptile stage, and so forth. You know, and it's pretty clear that that is a that notion is incorrect, is an oversimplification of something that's far, far, far more complicated.
It kind of looks that way, though. If you just look at the photos and the different stages of development, it's easy to see how people have thought that.
Yeah, but here's the subtle shift, and it actually relates to somebody who was working in the 1830s, and that is the meaningful comparison, one of the meaningful comparisons to make, is between embryos of different species. So to compare an embryo of a human to the embryo of a fish, that's a very meaningful comparison, not necessarily to compare the embryo of a human to an adult of a fish, because an embryo of a human never looks like an adult fish ancestor. An embryo of a human looks in some ways, not entirely, like a fish embryo. It looks, for instance, remember when I described the gill arches before? That's one similarity. The brain is very similar.
No, our caller Nick lost me on the other side of phylogeny there. Did you get the conversion evolution?
Convergent, yeah. So the other question, which is a really good one, he says, you know, what do we see, and what he was getting at is a really neat pattern, that, you know, oftentimes different lineages or different species hit on the same evolutionary solution. So the eye in a sort of a cephalopod like an octopus is very similar in some ways to a human eye, very sort of camera-like. We see this sort of pattern again and again and again. And, you know, that pattern begins to make a whole ton of sense when we begin to think about DNA. Remember I told you earlier in the show that what we're beginning to understand is the DNA recipe that builds bodies? Now, the big piece of this is that the DNA recipe that builds bodies, our own bodies, actually has roots that are very, very primitive and are shared among many different kinds of life forms. So this convergent evolution we were asked about for one piece of this, in some instances, although not all, one piece of this is that if you have two kinds of creatures that are using versions of the same recipe to build their bodies, they might well come on the same solution at the end of the day. You know, if one person's building a cake, baking a cake, you know, across town with the same recipe I'm using, and we're both experimenting with that recipe, it may very well be we have a very good chance of hitting upon the same cake if we do that, you know, trying to bake that cake enough. So that's the thing of convergent evolution.
Mm, what a picture. Let me get one more call from Charleston, South Carolina. Maureen, you're on the air.
Hi. I am calling from Charleston, South Carolina, the Bible Belt, and I just wanted to say to any of the creationists and literalists out there that it is nothing short of sad to me, because this to me is a beautiful story, starting from a single cell organism, coming up to fish, coming up to what we are today. That is the miracle, not an alakazam magical moment like pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
Well, there is certainly a tremendous grandeur about it and a sweep of time that's absolutely mind-boggling. Neil Shubin, but you know the other view, a counterview of the world. Mike Huckabee says, if you want to believe that you and your family came from apes, that's fine. I'll accept that. I just don't happen to think that I did. In your mind, is there room for a thinking person to reject evolution?
Well, if that's Huckabee's problem, apes, his real problem is far deeper. It's the fish, it's the worms, and it's the jellyfish, because that's where the recipe is. You know, I mean, there's so multiple levels here. For me, there's the science level. The magic and joy of science is discovery. It's about finding new things. Some of those new things are going to change your mind. Some of those things are going to take you in a new direction. Some of those things are going to answer old questions. But it's the importance of finding the new. And the only way I can do that if I subscribe to a doctrine itself that allows me to make discoveries, that allows me to make predictions, that allows me to tell when a hypothesis or an idea is wrong. And that's what science is about. You know, it doesn't address a creator. It doesn't address necessarily eternal truths, because science is not necessarily an eternal truth itself. It's the search for the discovery of truths. It itself is a quest. It's not an endpoint. And for me, that's a very big difference. Because it's a big difference in, you know, in what I do every day and what gets me out of bed in the morning, and that's the hope that I'll discover something new that'll change my worldview or sometimes support it.
Where's your next dig, and in what layer of ancient time, prehistoric time, Neil?
Well, actually, Ted Farish and I are planning to go back to the Arctic this summer up to Ellesmere Island to return to the tectolic sites. There's more up there to find. We actually have to leave a bunch of them up there every year because we're so far away from our supplies that we have weight limits. So there's still a bunch of tectolic to bring home. And we were going to go up in time and down in time just to learn more about this wonderful transition from life in water to life on land.
More news coming from 400 million years ago. Neil Shubin is author of Your Inner Fish, paleontologist at the University of Chicago. Neil, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great to have you. Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.